Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 30th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. From today's front page, top of the fold. Data show North Carolina tax burden shifts to the middle. By Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh. Middle-income residents of North Carolina increasingly have taken on a bigger chunk of the state's tax burden as the load has become less hefty for lower-income and upper-income taxpayers, according to a new analysis of data by the Office of State Controller David McCoy. The wealthiest 1.3% of North Carolina citizens paid 26.3% of state income taxes in 2000. By 2009, the latest year for which data is available, the tax bite on the highest earners, those making $200,000 and up, had declined to 23.8%, down 2.5 points. And what was happening at the top of the scale during those years was also happening at the bottom. Total taxes paid by the lowest income brackets, those making $0 to $50,000, fell by 6.2 points during those same years. Meanwhile, middle-income earners were caught in the squeeze. The tax bite on citizens making $50,000 to $200,000 increased from 36.8% of taxes paid in 2000 to 45.5% in 2009, up 8.7 points. The tax-paying data comes from the state's fiscal 2011 Comprehensive Annual Report, released in late December by McCoy's office. In a more than 50-page statistical section, McCoy presents chart after chart of raw information that adds up to a detailed financial snapshot of the state. Not included, however, are the names of the very wealthiest North Carolina taxpayers. Due to confidentiality issues, the names of the 10 largest revenue payers are not available, McCoy says. As a group, top income brackets filers sent in 59,000 tax returns in 2009, paying a total of $2.03 billion. Middle income earners filed 673,000 returns, paying $3.9 billion. From the lowest income brackets came 3.4 million returns in 2009 and tax payments totaling $2.6 billion. For many years, in an attempt to pass more of the burden to higher income groups, the state has used a progressive rate scale that taxes those in the upper income brackets at a higher level than lower to moderate income people. But what to make of the 2000 to 2009 payment results? NC State University economist Mike Walden points out that 2008 and 9 was a recessionary time during which upper-income earners took a hit when the value of their stock and other investments declined. It is a group that relies on income from capital gains, says Walden, and I could be wrong, but that's my first reaction. With less investment income arriving at their doorstep, in other words, the taxable income of the highest brackets also shrank. As to the nearly 9 percentage point drop between 2000 and 2009 in the taxes paid by the $0 to $50,000 income group, a couple of factors could have played a part. Rising unemployment lowered the income coming into the group. A second factor was a decision by state lawmakers in 07 to adopt the state version of the Earned Income Tax Credit for low to moderate income families. Dovetailing with the federal EITC, the state law gave those in low to moderate brackets an additional 5% break above the federal figure. More than 800,000 families have taken advantage of it. The Raleigh-based North Carolina Justice and Tax Center, and frequent critiques of North Carolina tax policy, labels state income taxes as being moderately progressive by national standards, but not progressive enough to keep lower-income tax earners from getting slammed when other taxes, sales, excise, and property are thrown into the mix. Total state and local taxes demand nearly 11% of the income of lower-income earners, but only 7.1% of the income of the wealthiest residents, according to the center's analysis. One remedy, among many, says the tax center's Alexandra Sirota, would be to lower the income tax rates for married couples making less than $200,000. Next up, payouts mount for ex-Duke doctor for malpractice, by Jason DeBruin, from Durham. Anil Patti, a cancer researcher and physician formerly with Duke University, has had 11 malpractice payments made in his name. The full amount of the payouts is not known, nor are the sources of the payments, whether they be from Patti, the university, or an insurance carrier. The North Carolina Medical Board requires only the payouts of $75,000 or more be listed under biographical information for a North Carolina physician, but there is no incremental or maximum listing requirement. Each payout could be any amount as long as it is more than $75,000, says Jean Fisher Brinkley, Public Affairs Director for the NC Medical Board. She says the $75,000 specified in the law is the floor. There is no ceiling. Patti resigned from Duke in 2010 after some of his cancer research was shown to be falsified. He was forced to retract 4 papers because of his faulty research, according to Retraction Watch, which tracks such matters. Clinical cancer trials based on Patti's research were called off, and Patti is facing lawsuits from participants or estates of deceased participants in those trials, for which Duke University and the Duke Healthcare System are also named defendants, as are various leaders from the university and health system. In one lawsuit brought by Joyce Schaffner, who participated in a trial based on some of Patti's research, Schaffner alleges the following, quote, "In written applications for millions of dollars in grant money to propel the Duke research, Patti knowingly, willfully, and fraudulently lied and included false and fraudulent information which research partner Joseph Nevins and or Duke University Health Systems knew or should have known was untrue, false, and fraudulent information," end quote. Schaffner is represented by Robert Zaytoon of the Zaytoon Law Firm in Raleigh, who said the lawsuit is in the very early stages. It is unclear what Patti has done since leaving Duke, but he is listed as a practicing physician at Coastal Cancer Center in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. His profile page there makes no reference to Patti's retracted research, lawsuits against him, or malpractice payments. Instead, the site tells a story that Dr. Patti is passionate about teaching and research. Over the past 10 years, including his time at Duke University, he has received several recognitions for mentoring, teaching, and research efforts. Additionally, there are a dozen websites, each with a variation of Dr. Anil or Patti in the web address. The sites all have a similar appearance and tout Patti's work as a physician or researcher or both. Besides being a successful clinician, Dr. Anil Patti also believes in working for the welfare of the society. He regularly donates his time and money to the local public school system and churches, in addition to supporting nonprofit organizations that help the growth and education of children in developing countries like India, reads a note at the www.anilpatti.com website. A website that tracks internet site registrations, whoosis.com, states that Anil Patti is the registrant of www.anilpatti.com. Many sites under similar names come up on the first page of a website search engine. Brian Chappell, a social search strategist with Ignite Social Media, explained that this tactic could move more desirable information to the top. Chappell was not asked about Patti in particular and was not told the subject matter for this article when contacted. He spoke only in generalities about why someone might create multiple pages. Triangle Business Journal has tried to reach Patti at the Coastal Cancer Center, but those who answer the phone say he is not available and messages go unreturned. Today's lead story on the center of the front page is Going Broke, $80 million failure of Clean Burn led bankruptcies. This article is written by Chris Bagley and is from Durham. Millions of dollars in debt was rolled up in bankruptcy filings in 2011, with many of the failures related to the beleaguered real estate markets. but none eclipsed the $80 million implosion of a company formed to cash in on an energy technology that's fallen short of early expectations. Ethanol producer Clean Burn Fuels idled its factory just west of Fayetteville in March, filed for Chapter 11 reorganization in April, and is all but certain to disappear from the map in the next few weeks, says John Northam, the company's bankruptcy attorney. Lenders foreclosed on the factory this fall and then sold it for $34.5 million, leaving the company with virtually no assets and mortgage lenders with losses of as much as $30 million. Clean Burn had raised at least $8.7 million in equity financing. Investors in the triangle included Governor's Club developer Kirk Bradley and Capital Broadcasting CEO Jim Goodman. The company's bankruptcy estate is, meanwhile, caught up in a litigation with Purdue Bioenergy, a sister company of the chicken processor, over which the company owed $5 million worth of corn at the plant. Payments owed to former employees and other creditors hinge on the outcome. While Chapter 11 is intended to allow companies to emerge from bankruptcy with a clean slate, a consultant hired by Clean Burn concluded that it would not be viable. That was the plan, and it didn't work, says Northern of Northern Blue in Chapel Hill. Northern says he plans to move towards a liquidation. The company's initial filing in the Durham Division of U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Middle District of North Carolina on April 3rd estimates its debts at $79.2 million, more than three times as much as the second largest bankruptcy in the eastern half of the state this year, according to an analysis by American City Business Journal's the parent company of Triangle Business Journal. 12 of the 15 largest bankruptcies in the analysis were related to real estate and included several coaster developers. A sampling is as follows. Sea Trail Corporation, the owner of a golf resort at Sunset Beach, filed for Chapter 11 reorganization in September with $22.2 million in debt, including $460,000 in unpaid property taxes and millions of dollars in the shareholder loans. The company has delayed filing its reorganization plan. Also, One Renaissance LLC, the owner of an office building off Wake Forest Road in Raleigh, filed for Chapter 11 reorganization on March 9th with $17.2 million in debt. One Renaissance was built to house Waste Industries and DeWitt Real Estate Services, and the LLC was created by the two company chief executives. Its Chapter 11 plan for debt restructuring was approved in late September. Also, Piedmont Center Investments, LLC, filed for Chapter 11 reorganization on August 11th with $15.5 million in debt, including $1.9 million owed to Capital Bank. The Raleigh-based company owns shopping centers in Pittsburgh and several other eastern North Carolina towns. The company's manager and part owner, Roger Camp, was indicted on federal charges of felony bank fraud in June. He has been released with a trial pending. The company's bankruptcy is also pending. Also, Wendell Falls Development, LLC, filed for Chapter 7 liquidation on November 28th with $9.5 million owed to creditors, including Triangle Contractors, engineers, architects, and attorneys. Burroughs and Chapin Company, Incorporated of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Mercury Development, LLC of Raleigh, formed the LLC to develop 1,400 acres of mostly residential land in eastern Wake County. The LLC lost its primary asset in 2010 when Wells Fargo foreclosed on the land. The three companies reflect continuing fallout from the real estate bubble that began to implode in 2007. While numbers of both personal and business bankruptcies have fallen from peaks reached in 2010 and 2011 in most jurisdictions, American Bankruptcy Institute Executive Director Sam Giordano says another foot is waiting to drop. Lenders have temporarily reduced payments for many corporate borrowers in what Giordano calls a game of extend, pretend, and amend. It's not a reflection of healthy economy, Giordano says. Annual total of debts owed by newly bankrupt companies aren't readily available. Giordano and several Triangle bankruptcy attorneys say those totals are probably shrinking, along with the decline in new filings. Publicly traded companies, which generally account for a tiny fraction of bankrupt companies, filed fewer bankruptcies in 2011. 81 through December 23rd, compared to 103 in the same period of 2010, according to bankruptcydata.com. But the scope of the bankruptcies is considerably larger, according to the data provider. An average of $1.24 billion in assets compared to the $853 million in 2010. Poynter Sproul attorney David Dink Warren, who represents creditors in bankruptcy cases, says lenders and their attorneys are still dealing with numerous bankruptcies filed in 2009 and 2010. A lot of the banks are taking a breath and catching up, Warren says. You can't flood too much into the system. Moving inside the front cover, UNC Health shuffling support work. This article is by Amanda Jones Hoyle and is from Durham. The UNC healthcare system wants to consolidate and expand back office operations for its pharmacy, materials management, and supply divisions in a deal that would relocate more than 150 system employees from various Triangle locations, including in Chapel Hill, to a warehouse in Durham. System representatives are negotiating to lease 92,877 square feet in a warehouse building at 4400 Emperor Boulevard in the Imperial Center Business Park in Durham, according to the December Council of State meeting agenda. The COS reviews building leases and property transactions for the state-supported organizations, but council members are not required to approve the terms of the deal. Phoenix Telecom Solutions is currently leasing all of the space in the 182,165-square-foot warehouse building on Emperor Boulevard, but Phoenix is planning to downsize into about half the space. That would make way for the UNC deal, says Clay Stober, a partner with the building's property management company, Tri Properties. The Cassidy Turley real estate firm is in charge of leasing the building. Chuck Morrow, Director of Materials Management for UNC Healthcare System, says the Durham facility would be operated as a shared services center that would provide both storage space for hospital supplies as well as offices for support staff who manage the hospital's supply and materials inventory. Morrow says that initially about 150 to 175 people would be relocated to the Durham facility. We're in a situation where we're growing, adding beds, and getting much busier, but the back office functions are compromised because of space constraints, he says. System officials have been working on the consolidation and expansion plan and searching for the appropriate facility for almost a year, he says. The Emperor Boulevard building meets their needs because it is midway between UNC Hospital in Chapel Hill and Rex Hospital in Raleigh, which is owned by UNC Healthcare System. Many of the employees would relocate from the Hendrick building on Friday Center Drive in Chapel Hill, as well as from offices on the hospital campus in Chapel Hill, Morrow says. UNC Healthcare Systems spokeswoman Karen McCall says the system is trying to consolidate other warehouse storage space it leases and occupies in a number of locations around the Triangle. McCall did not have any estimates of how much the consolidation plan would be saving the system. No new job positions are expected to be created following the move to Imperial Center. Everybody is trying to make space up here because there is none, she says. Continuing on the inside, volatile market propels firms to accelerate stock buybacks by Lee Weisbecker. This article was written from Raleigh. Unlike some of their corporate counterparts across North Carolina, Triangle publicly traded companies aren't jumping on the bandwagon of using stockpiled cash to buy back their own stock. The practice is considered a shareholder-friendly because it works to support the trading price of a company's shares. And since the repurchased shares are retired, buybacks give existing investors a larger stake in future earnings. Hardly noticed when times are good, stock buybacks can become controversial, however, when they happen at the same time a company is laying off workers and cutting facilities. In the Triangle, only 6 of 19 surveyed companies were cutting any sort of buyback at all. Were conducting any sort of buyback at all. Of those who did, a trio of purchases, among them the 1,850 share buyback done by Kerry-based The Pantry, for example, were small scale. Among the larger Triangle buyers, all of which have expanded or held the line on employment, were open source software vendor Red Hat repurchased 961,329 shares at an average price of $42.77 from June through August, according to the company's filings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. That would be a total of around $41 million. Also, Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank repurchased 87,339 Class A shares in August-September for an average of $149.51 per share, or about $13 million. They have plenty of capital, and they think the stock is undervalued. That's what it's all about, says analyst Brett Shiner of FBR Capital Markets. Also, in August and September, synthetic gem maker Charles & Covard bought back 141,617 shares at $2.33 a share for a total of about $330,093, according to SEC documents. Other Triangle firms prepped themselves for buybacks, but at the end of the third quarter hadn't yet pulled the trigger. The board of Durham-based Cree, for example, approved a $200 million buyback plan September 25th, but no shares have been purchased under it as of mid-October. A statewide survey of publicly traded companies turns up examples of firms whose buybacks have come even as they shrank payrolls. Morrisville-based Lowe's Companies, the home improvement chain, bought back 98.9 million shares for $2.3 billion during the 9 months ending October 28th, according to SEC filings. In mid-October, the company announced plans to shutter 20 stores and cut 1,950 employees. As for comment, Lowe's Public Relations Manager Karen Cobb says, "This is nothing new," referring to the firm's stock repurchase program. That program, amended by the Lowe's board in August, authorizes the repurchase of up to $5 billion in common stock, with the buys coming in either open market or private transactions. Quote, shares purchased are retired and returned to authorized and unissued status, end quote, the firm says in an SEC filing. A second company, Greensboro-based RF Micro Devices, repurchased 1.7 million shares for $8.84 for $8.84 million between July and October. In July, the company announced 80 layoffs in the face of cutbacks from cell phone maker Nokia. Attempts to reach company spokesman Doug DeLeo for comment were not successful. Nationally, for 2011 through December 21st, buybacks have surged to $524 billion, up 40% from 2010, says Rob Liepert of Westport, Connecticut-based Brignani Associates, a stock tracking firm. Companies flush with capital, he says, choose the stock buyback as a middle position between longer-term commitments, such as hiring more workers, for example, or paying or increasing shareholder dividends. The buyback avoids those larger commitments, he adds, while signaling to both shareholders and the wider market that they believe their stock is undervalued. Next up, continued industry softness may bolster MLN's buyout bid. This article is written by Chris Bagley and is from Raleigh. Martin Marietta Materials' hostile takeover bid for Vulcan Materials Company has a chance of succeeding because of the softness in the construction industry, Vulcan shareholders say. Raleigh-based Martin Marietta, the nation's number two supplier of aggregates used in construction, has repeatedly cited the industry's continuing slump as the reason for its nearly $5 billion bid for Vulcan, based in Birmingham, Alabama. Prior to making its offer public on December 12, Martin Marietta had been negotiating with Vulcan for more than a year. Now the Raleigh company is taking its case to Vulcan shareholders based largely on its higher ratio of revenue to debt obligations, its larger dividends, and a historic slump in the construction industry that is pressing companies to reduce overhead costs. In the past 4 years, Vulcan has lost $113 million, while Martin Marietta has posted earnings of $426 million. Vulcan shares also have fared worse, down 52% since 2008, compared to a 24% decline for Martin Marietta. And Vulcan recently cut its quarterly dividend to 1 penny, compared to Martin Marietta's 40% per share dividend. That is 40-cent per share dividend. Several large Vulcan shareholders say Martin Marietta's bid looks more attractive with each passing month that construction spending stays in the doldrums. Vulcan's business depends heavily on spending by federal and state governments. It would behoove participants in the industry to talk about consolidation as a way to survive, says Bill Kaltzman, a portfolio manager with Birmingham Capital Management Incorporated, whose ownership stake in Vulcan amounted to $2.4 million as of September 30th. We certainly think it would be productive for the companies. It doesn't cost anything to talk. Vulcan said on December 22nd that it's not interested and announced its board's unanimous vote to reject the offer. Its executives have maintained that Vulcan is positioned to recover strongly as construction picks up and have frequently pointed to economic data that support their contention that it's already happening. Analysts say Vulcan has indeed suffered more deeply in the Great Recession due to both its exposure to Sunbelt states and their real estate bubbles, and to the company's heavier debt load, much of which is associated with the acquisition of a Florida competitor in 2007. The company has been profitable in only one of the last 4 years. Without interest expense, it would have been profitable in all four. Bristol Cone Value Partners LLC analyst Josh Graybill says the flip side is that a recovery in the industry is likely to benefit Vulcan shareholders more if the company remains independent. Graybill, whose company has a $1.1 million stake in Vulcan, says he is slightly against the acquisition but will warm to it if construction spending doesn't begin to recover soon. Meanwhile, the two companies are suing each other in three states, most recently on December 19th when Vulcan accused Martin Marietta in federal court of using confidential information to argue publicly for the deal. Martin Marietta lawsuits in state courts in New Jersey, where Vulcan is incorporated, and in Delaware seek to ensure that Vulcan shareholders are able to approve the proposal directly with a simple majority vote. Meanwhile, Vulcan could adopt what's known as a poison pill, a provision that would flood the market with thousands of new shares. Raleigh attorney Jim Verdonik says courts typically don't invalidate a poison pill if the target company argues convincingly that it's merely using the poison pill as leverage for a higher price. Kaltzman says Martin Marietta would be more likely to succeed with the participation of Vulcan executives than without. But a higher bid from Vulcan or a lingering slump in construction spending would make him likely to back the deal even without their blessing. Vulcan shares quickly rose above Martin Marietta's implied offer price and have remained higher, indicating investors' confidence that a higher bid may come. Institutional Shareholder Services spokesman Ted Allen says the advisory firm hasn't issued a recommendation on the deal, but adds that overlapping shareholder bases can help deals go through. Dozens of large funds own shares in both companies. Glenn Ireland II, whose grandfather and brother ran the company that evolved into Vulcan from 1916 to 1958, urged support for the acquisition in a December 19 letter to Vulcan's board. Ireland said he had met and discussed the offer with Martin Marietta CEO Ward Nye and praised Nye's performance at the company. Ireland owns $40 million in Vulcan shares. Quote, I would welcome the opportunity to be part of a combined company that would be financially stronger and more profitable than Vulcan on its own, end quote, Ireland writes. And now time for Legal Focus from Jim Verdonik. Let's try to learn from mistakes as we embark on 2012. What I like about New Year's is that we shed the excess baggage and mistakes of the old year and start fresh. But let's try to learn from mistakes before we discard them to the trash bin of history. Of course, the cheapest lessons are lessons from the mistakes of others. Here are some 2011's biggest mistakes and what we should learn from them. AT&T's acquisition of T-Mobile. Be careful about betting on things you don't control. When the Federal Trade Commission rejected AT&T's acquisition of T-Mobile, it triggered a payment of a $4 billion breakup fee to T-Mobile by AT&T. That's a lot to bet on the whims of a government agency. MF Global. People sometimes lie and steal to hide their mistakes. Encourage your team to admit mistakes by reacting reasonably to mistakes. Be extra vigilant when business is bad. Employees may be tempted to cover their mistakes by borrowing other people's money. For small businesses, this may mean not paying the government payroll taxes withheld from employees' salaries to help the business survive cash flow problems. People go to jail for this type of borrowing. A Tale of Two Dictators. If you're going to do something people won't like, don't broadcast it to the world before you do it. Muammar Gaddafi publicly threatened to slaughter his enemies and make the streets run red with the blood of their children. That announcement prompted outside intervention. You're probably not planning to commit mass murder in your business, but take a lesson from a smarter dictator than Gaddafi in conducting your business. You can often avoid trouble by doing things quietly. President Assad of Syria seems to have learned that lesson as he proceeds to quietly kill his opponents without outside intervention. Solyndra. Trying to force a niched product into a mass market before consumers are willing to pay for it means that everyone loses money. Now that European countries are going broke, subsidies for solar power are drying up. All the Chinese solar panel manufacturers are losing money. Subsidies are a temporary fix until you run out of money. If instead of subsidizing mass deployment before its time, people had focused on niche applications where solar power currently makes more sense, like military applications, trucks, RVs, boats, and the off-the-power-grid vacation homes, the solar industry might be in better shape today. And refinancing myths. Until the U.S. housing market crashed in 2008, people thought they could always refinance their adjustable-rate mortgages. Instead, they faced rising interest rates when they couldn't refinance short-term debt. We would like to think people learned lessons about borrowing to finance long-term projects using short-term debt. Alas, here we are 3 years later with European governments having major difficulties when they try to refinance their short-term sovereign debt. Pay attention to your financial statements and closely manage your short-term liabilities, short-term assets, and cash flow. It doesn't matter that you project a big profit in 2013 if you run out of money in 2012. My last advice for the year comes from Thomas Edison. Quote, "Opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and it looks like work." End quote. Mr. Verdonik is an attorney with Ward & Smith, PA in Raleigh. Going to spend a few minutes looking back at the top stories in the Triangle for 2011. The Triangle was abuzz with deal-making, with companies going public, firms getting sold to private equity firms, ownership changing hands, and some big names saying goodbye to their jobs. We had it all. Here's a recap of the big stories in 2011. The number one story for 2011 was the Progress sale, and Raleigh was to lose a major headquarters. The news on January 8th that Duke Energy Corporation planned to acquire Progress Energy Corporation pleased investors, worried Progress neighbors in downtown Raleigh, and set off cascades of activity at regulatory agencies and in Raleigh's real estate market, not to mention at the two utilities themselves, which employ a total of some 29,000 people. If the acquisition goes through in 2012, the company's corporate structures would merge. While the deal would affect the company's various operating utilities, they would remain independent and separately regulated for several years. Nearly 12 months into the process, all of that seems more likely to happen than not. Shareholders of the two companies approved the deal overwhelmingly in August. Various regulators have set conditions and extracted promises from the companies, but haven't indicated an intent to block the deal. In response, the company's share prices have zigzagged gradually upwards and nearly in lockstep. Duke's December 28th closing price implied a total value of $16.9 billion to Progress shareholders. The scope of the job loss has been clear to about 600 to 1,000 in downtown Raleigh as the utility comes under the control of Duke's Charlotte headquarters. Progress said in early December that 508 employees in Raleigh had accepted voluntary severance packages, leaving 100 to 400 jobs to cut through a combination of layoffs, transfers, and the elimination of positions that are now empty. Moves by Raleigh-based software company Red Hat have helped to cushion the impact. Just 2 days after the news of Duke Progress merger broke, Red Hat said it would not leave Wake County, as it had previously considered and pledged to hire 540 people here in the months ahead. In late August, a few days before the utilities announced the exact scope of the job cuts, Red Hat confirmed that it was in sublease negotiations with Progress and later consummated aims to move its 600 employees into the building from North Carolina State University's Centennial Campus. Red Hat is also set to take Progress's place as the Triangle's largest publicly traded company by market value. Duke and Progress executives have pitched the acquisition as a means to boost their bargaining power vis-a-vis suppliers of coal, other fuels, and services, a move they said would save customers and shareholders about $700 million in fuel cost. Throughout the year, customers have asked the North Carolina Utilities Commission to demand a guarantee of those ostensible savings, or at least to guarantee that the acquisition wouldn't push the electricity rates higher. The cities of Rocky Mount and New Bern opposed the deal outright and in the form of state legislation introduced by friendly representatives. Environmental groups intervened in merger-related proceedings before regulators in South Carolina, where Duke is the dominant utility, and assented to the deal only after the utilities pledged an accelerated shift from coal toward renewable energy. Regulators there in North Carolina and at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission appear close to final rulings on the acquisition, though the companies have not fully addressed FERC's concerns about the competition in the wholesale market. Regulators in Kentucky, another Duke-dominated state, approved the deal in August with a condition that rates not be raised within 2 years. The number two story for 2011 is that Red Hat has committed to building a company in the Triangle. And it was back in the third quarter of 2010 when Triangle Business Journal wrote a story about the open source company scouting sites in other states for a 300,000 square foot headquarters building. At that time, little did anyone know that events that were going to unfold in the next 6 months would cement Red Hat's future in Raleigh. In January, the company, which boasts nearly $1 billion in sales and has $1 billion in cash, decided it would remain in Wake County, where Red Hat was launched, and began a search for a new corporate headquarters. That prompted developers to quickly go to the drawing board to present CEO Jim Whitehurst and his management team with options, one of which was a brand new office tower in downtown Raleigh. That sounded tempting to Red Hat leaders, especially since a real estate company probably would have built the tower for the company as long as it signed a long-term lease to take most of the space in the building. But then came the news that Duke Energy had made an offer to buy the area's largest company, Progress Energy, which built a new 19-story tower in 2004. The building's owner is J.P. Morgan Trust Company, but Progress holds a lease that does not expire until 2035. Red Hat wanted to make a statement of its presence, and Progress was given the company an opportunity to do just that. And just like that, a deal was done. Red Hat decided to move into Progress's building once Progress is absorbed under the Duke flag. Quote, "There's very little doubt. We were all very happy to see that a local company is going to pick up that space," end quote, says Wake County manager David Cook. but we probably lost an opportunity to see another $100 million tower in downtown Raleigh. And that may be true, but the downtown real estate market could have been devastated if so much space came available in such a short period of time. Ask Whitehurst, and he may say that Progress made an offer he just could not refuse. And there were sweeteners from state and local governments as well. In all, Red Hat will receive some $15 million in incentives for a two-tiered expansion. Wake County added another $675,000 not long ago to show its appreciation. In return, Red Hat promised to add about 500 jobs, although Wake County will be satisfied if the company creates only 50 new jobs by 2013 and spends $30 million once it moves into the Progress Tower. The Red Hat decision to stay in Wake County could be one of the biggest business deals for years to come, especially if the Linux company continues to grow at the rapid pace it has. CEO Whitehurst, who was chosen TBJ's 2011 Business Person of the Year, has laid out a bullish plan for a company that is ready to venture into new business lines such as cloud storage and expand its international footprint. Not bad for a company that started out when a Canadian named Bob Young, who ran an outfit called ACC Corporation, decided to combine ACC with Red Hat in 1995. In 1999, Red Hat went public and Young became a billionaire on the first day of trading. In the past 16 years, Red Hat always has been in the news for factors ranging from its cult-like opposition to the way Microsoft does business to colorful leaders such as Young and Matthew Selznick, who never shied away from a good fight with Linux critics. Today, Whitehurst runs a company that has matured, has established a place in the technology ladder, and is being viewed as a serious threat by players such as Microsoft, Oracle, and others. The number three story for 2011 is that the Canadians gave up on RBC and are going to sell the bank to the PNC. Lee Reisbecker wrote that the Pittsburgh-based PNC Financial will close out on 2011 on a high note, having won Federal Reserve Bank's approval for the $3.45 billion financing plan it put forward to acquire RBC Bank USA. The deal remains on track to receive a final nod from regulators by March 2012, with PNC expected to complete the 428-branch signage and back-office conversion in a single weekend. In the shorter term, Fed approval of the financial part of the deal was a significant step for PNC CEO James Rohr and his lieutenants. As the bank points out in a recent filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the regulatory green light means PNC won't have to take the dilutive step of selling more shares of common stock to raise additional capital in connection with the RBC buy. And that, in turn, means that whatever earnings PNC can begin to pull out of its new southern footprint, a banking property stretching from Virginia through the Carolinas into Florida, will begin showing up on the Pittsburgh Bank's bottom line almost immediately. Given PNC's record with acquisitions and with making them pay off, few analysts question the bank's ability to repeat its past performance south of the Mason-Dixon line. Says analyst Richard Bove of Rochdale Securities of the PNC style, quote, they like to think of themselves that they have the ability to take any bank, anywhere, and turn it around, end quote. News of the RBC deal broke in June after PNC reportedly outbid Winston-Salem-based BB&T for RBC Bank, the U.S. banking arm of Royal Bank of Canada. For PNC, success in the bidding meant an expansion opportunity outside its native Rust Belt and into the faster-growing Sun Belt. For Royal Bank of Canada, it meant the end of a dicey, decade-long experiment that began with its acquisition of Rocky Mount-based Centura Bank in 2001. Doubling the size of the Centura franchise through a series of Deep South acquisitions over the years, Royal Bank then ran headfirst into the region's real estate downturn. Tallying up troubled construction and other types of loans, RBC Bank USA posted losses of $629 million in 2007, $1.2 billion in 2008, $854 million in 2009, and $320 million in 2010. Through the third quarter of 2011, the continued bleeding amounted to $428 million, according to the FDIC. After searching in vain for a turnaround formula, Royal Bank opted instead to sell. Unanswered yet with Royal Bank's departure and PNC's arrival is how deep post-acquisition cost-cutting will affect RBC Bank's current employee roster of 4,747 employees. That includes about 500 who work in the Triangle and in a remaining back-office operation in Rocky Mount. PMC officials have said they eventually expect to cut $230 million from the RBC footprint, about $150 million in the first year. On December 15th, members of the Raleigh-based Centennial Authority, the landlord of the RBC Center, approved a name change for the facility to PNC Arena. PNC inherited the center, home of Carolina Hurricanes hockey and NC State men's basketball, as part of its purchase of RBC Bank. We're going to jump down the list a little bit, and the number seven story for 2011 is that after years of waiting, Raleigh has taken center stage, and the community pulled out all the stops to put on a lavish show as the NHL All-Stars came calling. Cameron Snipes writes that while Raleigh may not have much to celebrate on the hockey front these days, the area was abuzz in late January of this year when it hosted its first National Hockey League All-Star game. A feat that some say was the largest special event in the city's history, and it brought with it a global spotlight and financial rewards to boot. I beg your pardon. 5 years after the Carolina Hurricanes hosted a Lord Stanley's Cup, the City of Oaks welcomed the NHL's brightest and best pucksters over a three-day weekend filled with festivities. But getting Raleigh ready to play host city took years of preparation. Way back in 2001, Civic Boosters began working together to achieve the goals that would convince NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman to award an All-Star game to Raleigh. And in the years leading up to 2011 star-studded weekend, it had transformed into a hockey town that in 2006 boasted the league's best team and has since held its own in league attendance. In the end, the advent of a suitable convention center, more high-quality hotels, and well-earned hockey prowess paved the way for the Triangle's first Major League All-Star event. But it was more than a single game. The weekend included a number of events designed to impress NHL top talent and entertain fans. These included weekend-long events such as the NHL Fan Fair that featured special appearances by various league stars and All-Star-wide Open, which served as a street party festival all along Fayetteville Street. The weekend also featured more events designed to allow the players to interact with the fans, including the All-Star 5K, a charity-run walk to benefit the Carolina Hurricane Kids and Community Foundation. The RBC Center then became the absolute center of attention on Sunday when the NHL's 58th annual midseason spectacular took center stage. All told, the weekend of January 28th through the 30th provided an opportunity for Raleigh to shine on a brighter stage. Quote, in my opinion, it was one of the largest, if not the largest, special event in Raleigh's history, at least in terms of size and scope and the international attention it created for the city, end quote, Vice President for Sports Marketing at the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Sport Bureau, Scott Dupree, said in a response to emailed questions. The quote continues, it was an overwhelming success by any measure, but topping that list was probably the avalanche of praise that the Hurricanes and the Raleigh area received as host, end quote. In addition to the heightened awareness of North Carolina's capital city brought on by the big game, the area reaped a pretty substantial financial windfall from the festivities. In early March, the Raleigh CVB released a statement that calculated that All-Star Weekend activities generated an estimated $11.4 million in direct visitor spending for Raleigh and Wake County and produced $49 million in media value for the area. And the influx of people to Raleigh area wasn't anything to sneeze at either. The All-Star events attracted 18,900 visitors from outside the area and generated 10,551 hotel room nights. Total attendance figures, including both local and out-of-town attendees for the weekend's festivities, was estimated to be 138,000, according to the CVB. Quote, "We are very proud of how this entire community came together to make NHL All-Star Weekend in the Triangle a tremendous success," end quote. Hurricanes General Manager Jim Rutherford said in a statement. He also said, "It is clear from the comments of the fans, media, and executives who came to North Carolina that the weekend made a tremendous impact on their impressions of this market." Moving on to the number 9 event for 2011 business. Terminal 2 finished and Brantley steps aside. Chris Bagley writes, "Given that he was in his late 60s and had just overseen completion of one of the biggest construction projects ever in the Triangle, the March announcement that John Brantley would retire as CEO, director in industry lingo, of Raleigh-Durham International Airport was no surprise. But like any inevitable loss coming to fruition, it still stung. RDU has literally grown up with the Triangle, advancing from little more than an airfield for general aviation aircraft in 1977 with about 50 employees to an international airport with two runways, a striking new terminal with renovation of an existing terminal underway that provides jobs for more than 5,000 people. More than 10 million passengers travel through RDU's terminals each year, boarding or leaving some 200 separate flights. The year 1977 was a milestone in the direction of RDU. It was in that year that Brantley, with an undergraduate degree in civil engineering from NC State and a master's in civil engineering from Northwestern University, took a job at the airport as an engineering assistant. Within 5 years, he had risen to the position of director of the airport, a job he held until October, when he was succeeded by Michael Landguth, who had been president and CEO of the Chattanooga Metropolitan Airport Authority since 2004. Brantley, who was born in Raleigh and graduated from Broughton High School, was bitten by the aviation bug as a youngster when his dad would take him and his brother Drew on rides around the town. One of the stops was the local airport when Brantley remembers horsing around with his brother as planes soared above them. When selected as Triangle Business Journal's Business Person of the Year for 2010, Brantley recalled those trips to the airfield with his father, quote, "Truly, my being here is due to him doing that," he told a TBJ reporter. But at that time, he wasn't envisioning running an airport. What youngster would choose that over flying one of those planes? And that's what Brantley wanted to do. It turned out that his eyesight was not good enough to be considered for flying military planes, the surest way in those days to obtain a career as a pilot. Yet, upon obtaining his master's degree from Northwestern, Brantley's first job was with the FAA. He operated his own airport planning company before joining RDU. The story chronicling Brantley's selection as a TBJ Business Person of the Year, published in the December 31, 2010 issue, stated, quote, "Indeed, Brantley seems to have stepped straight out of a Hollywood movie about the glory days of NASA. Central casting couldn't have found a better man to run mission control because Brantley has the proverbial right stuff. A candid, no-nonsense style, encyclopedic knowledge of the industry, and above all, a get-the-job-done-right competence," end quote. The man who built RDU International Airport into a major cog in the economic center dynamo that the Triangle has become made his retirement known in the same manner he did his job, efficiently and without fanfare, announcing it before a regular meeting of his board. While parking decks, the rental car facilities, the network of roads, the variety of concessions, all are on Brantley's done list at the airport, the modern, roomy, and impressive Terminal 2 stands as a monument to his life's work. Quote, "I think that will be known as his legacy," former RDU Airport Authority Chairman Rob Teer has said. And now it's time for our guest column from Jennifer Nicey-Connor. Jennifer Nicey-Connor is a special sections producer for the Washington Business Journal, a sister publication of the TBJ. Every office needs a dose of Dickens. Old Marley was dead as a doornail. I've always been fascinated by Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It probably began somewhere back in the seventh grade when I first appeared in a school production of it one winter and was introduced to Dickens' lyrical, masterful writing. Since then, I can't watch a production or film version of the story without silently reciting many of the verses verbatim. No matter how many times I hear the dialogue, I find something new in it. A TV version was on in the background recently, and I found myself tuning in to the message carried by the ghost of Jacob Marley. Marley's role is to come back and issue a message, one that can either be viewed as a cautionary tale or an olive branch of hope. The short version, you have so many opportunities to do good in your world each day, don't pass them up. As I half listened to Scrooge and Marley's back and forth, it suddenly struck me how much that applies not only to our personal lives but also to our office worlds. Think of an instance of kindness that was shown to you at some point in your career. Maybe someone gave you a chance at a job you had no business holding. Perhaps someone helped you correct a mistake, or maybe it was that simple kind word a superior said about something you had done, which still makes you smile to this day. When was the last time you did that for someone else? I can think of countless times colleagues and bosses have shown that kind of kindness to me. In one of my very first jobs, when I was the world's worst receptionist for a production company, I discovered I had sent a tape to the wrong location and fully feared the wrath of the producer. Another kind producer heard my fretting, called him up, and casually mentioned the tape would be a bit delayed, allowing me to fix it. She just smiled and winked, and it meant volumes to me. Each and every day we have the opportunity to make someone's professional world just a little bit better, but it's something we so rarely realize. That higher up who made your year by offering up the good job probability never realized how much that meant to you. As we advance in our careers, that power surges for all of us. The roles are reversed and you are now in the driver's seat of praise. Could you make someone's professional life that much better by simply taking the time to notice and thank them? May we all find some inspiration in Jacob Marley's message and use it many times over in the coming year. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the TBJ will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.